You are listening to The Vitals, a bi-monthly podcast for all things oncology nursing. For even more content, check out oncologynursingnews.com or find Oncology Nursing News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Hi everyone, this is Lindsay Fisher, Associate Editor at Oncology Nursing News. For this episode of The Vitals, Loida Braithwaite, an oncology nurse practitioner at the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center in Madison, and Jamie Carroll, a nurse practitioner at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, both weigh in and highlight presentations from the 2022 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium that they believe will influence oncology nursing practice. Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So I really just am interested in what you think are some of the key pieces of data research that have come out of this meeting. And so I guess just start with that question. Did anything really catch your eye?
Yeah. So I think what I found very interesting is how much we are discovering within the HER2 positive population. I know that this is something that we have been kind of stagnant for a few years, but now with the development in some more data from some of the, especially the Destiny Breast 02 and 03, confirming what we previously knew with TDXD. I think this is very, very good, very informative how we're seeing, you know, that data is, you know, definitely maturing more, and we're seeing the advantages in the overall progression-free survival for our patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, particularly because we know we have definitely more options for our early breast cancer, but when it comes to the metastatic setting, sometimes we are left with not too many options. But I think this is very good and interesting, seeing the data from these two confirmatory trials. I think also as time, you know, goes and we learn more, we treat more patients with TDXD, I think this is also making us more aware of some of the side effects that we're going to start seeing in some of these people, some of these patients, particularly with the pulmonary involvement, more ILD. It looks like the rate still remains low, but it's raising more awareness and how early we have to detect it. I think, you know, when CDK4/6 inhibitors came, we know that there was the risk for, you know, ILD and some sort of pulmonary compromise. But now with more patients being treated with TDXD, I think those rates definitely have a risk of increasing or being more common. So for us practitioners, I think it's raising the attention that we have to be on top of that early on. So that is in terms of folks with HER2 positivity in the metastatic setting. I also found very interesting for patients with hormone receptor positive, in terms of the sacituzumab govitecan with the TROPICS 02 trial, because we knew from other years about triple negative and the, you know, sacituzumab govitecan, et cetera, for treatment metastatic setting. But now we're seeing for patients with hormone receptor positive too, we saw some data that the, regardless of their TROP2 expression, there may be some benefit for those patients as well in terms of progression-free survival for folks. I think this was a post ad hoc analysis, you know, after. I think that this is just shining light and potentially, you know, more treatments for with hormone receptor positive. So I also liked the trial USB12 with the TALENT trial too, that was looking at, to me, the whole world now of HER2 low. To me, this is magnificent, you know, because before we were saying, oh, everyone with HER2 1, you know, plus 1, plus 2 is like, eh, they're considering nothing, etc. But now it's opening this door just for all these patients that we can target, you know, with a low HER2, that we have options now, and how this particular trial was looking into TDXD alone and TDXD with endocrine therapy for patients with too low and hormone receptor positive, and in the setting of neoadjuvant, you know, because before we, you know, we have options of neoadjuvant therapy, endocrine therapy alone, and then see how it responds, etc. But, you know, sometimes we were missing those people that may have been high risk because, you know, then, you know, maybe nodal involvement that we were not aware, clinically aware, et cetera. But now how the data, you know, it's still not fully out there, not fully mature, but seems promising that we may be able in the future to utilize T-DXd in the neoadjuvant setting as well as potentially a single therapy, you know, or in combination with an, you know, endocrine therapy as well. So I really liked that part. Another thing fascinating to look into in the setting of patients, you know, how we are dividing in terms of the approach to treat the patients with metastatic disease and HER2 positivity. You know, are we dealing with someone who has brain mets versus someone who doesn't have brain mets? And kind of how that combination with some other agents that will target some of the intracranial disease like neratinib, et cetera. You know, right now the trials are ongoing with T-DM1 plus neratinib. I think it will be interesting to also, there was mention about some trials with T-DXd in addition to other medications like, you know, neratinib, et cetera. And how that will be looking at, I think. Another piece, the promise of the SERDs, the oral SERDs,
yeah,
that are coming. Yeah, I think that was the big thing too in San Antonio this year, potentially practice changing, you know, analyzing the big ones. I think the AMIRA 3 definitely showed that, you know, they didn't meet the primary endpoint. The Emerald trial with the ELASIS trends, I think that one, you know, did have some positive data that may be, you know, promising. Especially if we do, you know, have in combination with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, looks like pretty promising.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, would you say that there is potential for the SERDs to make a difference in this setting?
Oh, I definitely think that there is potential because, you know, right now we, you know, for decades have been with the options of either, you know, we have the SERMs and we have your aromatase inhibitors, you know, in this particular case, you know, we had fulvestrant, but, you know, administration, et cetera, bioavailability has been an issue, especially with SERDs. I think this is taking so long, but it could be practice changing. Imagine if we had, you know, oral SERDs approved when it comes to having an extra line of endocrine therapy for patients or another option that does not require traveling for patients. Access will be better because this is like, you know, an oral.
Right.
Patients commute every month, etc., get an injection, you need a healthcare professional to administer. I think that this is exciting and it could be, you know, practice changes. And as the data matures, I can only imagine, you know, all the trials that will come down the pipe with all this approved in combination with other agents as well. So I think to me, this is very exciting from the clinician perspective, but also from the patient perspective to think about the accessibility that we're going to have to treat them, you know.
Hello.
Hi.
Just to start off, could you just run down some of the major pieces from this year's SABCS that you think are of interest to you and of interest to other nurses and nurses professionals?
Yeah, so I think that one of the ones that was discussed this year was the positive study. So the positive study was a pregnancy outcome and safety of interrupting therapy for women with endocrine responsive breast cancer. Because I think that's always the question, right? Is patients that have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer and are of childbearing age want to know if they can interrupt their endocrine therapy to achieve pregnancy. This study was a prospective single arm study to address that question. Is it safe from a breast cancer perspective? And will that increase their risk of breast cancer relapse? So the study was looking at only women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Patients were less than 42 years of age. About 43% of them were upper 30s. 75% of them had no number of births ahead of breast cancer diagnosis. And then almost all of them were stage 1 or 2 breast cancer. Stage 3 was only 6% of patients. They had varying therapy with or without OFS, SERM, or AI. About 62% of them had prior chemotherapy, and then about half and half had mastectomy versus lumpectomy. And they had to have gotten 18 months of adjuvant endocrine therapy, not more than 30 months of endocrine therapy. They did allow prior neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy plus or minus fertility preservation. And then they couldn't have had any clinical evidence of recurrence. And so patients who had 18 to 30 months of adjuvant endocrine therapy. They stopped their endocrine therapy, had a 3-month washout, and then they were allowed up to 2 years to attempt pregnancy, conceive, deliver, and breastfeed, which included the 3-month washout. And then if no pregnancy was achieved by a year, they recommended fertility assessment. And so the primary endpoint was breast cancer-free interval from time of enrollment. And so the outcomes are showing that pausing the endocrine therapy does not impact short-term disease outcomes. You know, I think this study will show over time, we want more mature data as well, but what they're seeing right now, it's not. So it's helpful.
Yeah, definitely. You know, is this something that you see a lot in your practice as women who are in this phase of receiving adjuvant and they ask you about this? And is this something that you're going to point them to? And how might you talk about those conversations?
Yeah. I think I have this conversation frequently with patients because I have many premenopausal women that have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. I actually had this conversation today with a 20-something year old woman who is getting her last cycle of neoadjuvant chemotherapy and is already asking, hey, can I look at getting pregnant in the future? And so it's a common discussion that we have. And it's helpful to know that the positive trial did not see that disrupting their endocrine therapy impacted disease outcomes. So right. I think that that's super helpful for patients and providers to know that they're not seeing an increase in recurrence when endocrine therapy is paused to achieve pregnancy.
And looking at the study, are there certain patients you might still have reservations about? Obviously, this was only, they could only follow up for 3 years. So relatively short follow-up time. What questions do you still have as a provider when you're having these conversations moving forward?
Yeah, so I think my questions that I have are patients that achieve a pregnancy and then go back on their endocrine therapy. Will we recommend that they take it for another 18 months and then they can achieve another pregnancy? Or what, because on the positive study, these patients were they might have had more than one birth, but it looks like they had twin births, not necessarily more than one pregnancy. So I think that's my outstanding question that I have is there safety in pausing it once again?
Yeah, that's a really great point.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Vitals. If you're interested in learning more about SABCS, be sure to check out our conference coverage. The link can be found below. In addition, if you have insights that you'd like to share, key research from the recent symposium that you believe will influence nursing practice, be sure to send us an email at lfisher@mghlifesciences.com. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to never miss a beat with Oncology Nursing News.